Hello and welcome back to the Millennial Ag Podcast, where agriculture is always on tap and no topic is off limits. Thanks for joining us today, your co-hosts, Valene Cawhorn and Catherine Lotsbeach.
Hey guys, welcome to this week's episode. It is the middle of summer. It is hot, hot, hot here out in the Western United States. And I'm pretty sure for our guest in Washington, D.C., it likely is too, not just climactically, but politically. We are bringing back our very favorite political commentator, Mr. Tanner Beamer from National Cattlemen's this week. Hey, Tanner, welcome back.
I've never been described as a political commentator before, but I appreciate that very much. And it's always glad to be with you guys.
You are now. I hope you're okay with it. You can add that to your resume.
There we go. Talking head.
Well, listeners, I'm sure it will come as no surprise to you, but Valene and I have been thinking an awful lot about what is being called the Big Beautiful Bill, signed by the Trump administration just a few weeks ago, on July 4th, as a matter of fact. And of course, we had questions about how that whole thing will be affecting agriculture, especially the protein and beef sector. So Tanner, what have you got for us?
Well, I will tell you that that was quite the legislative undertaking, and it's certainly been in the news quite a bit in the last several months. But really, the groundwork for this legislation started to be laid by Republican leadership, particularly in the House, but also in the Senate, going back like a year and a half ago when they were looking at the maps for the election and saying, hey, if somehow we are able to clinch all three levers of the lawmaking process, being the House, the Senate, Republican majorities, and a Republican president, here's kind of the base package that we would like to get over the finish line in order to rescind some of the Biden-era policies, in order to codify some of the Trump tax cuts from 2017 and the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, and accomplish a whole bunch of other things in the meantime. I will tell you that when Trump was campaigning and he said, we just want one big, beautiful bill, I thought, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That sounds like a reconciliation package, but I had no idea that the actual given title of the bill was going to be the One Big Beautiful Bill Act.
Yes, it's a little disconcerting.
Yeah, I was like, okay, well, there it is. He is nothing if not, I think I described him on the radio the other day as loquacious, and I got a lot of text messages after that. So we'll stick with loquacious.
I think I might send you a text message after that. Tanner.
Like I said, the groundwork started to get laid a long, long time ago. And obviously on election night, it became pretty clear that Republicans had won the White House and the Senate. And it was not too long after that that we confirmed that they were going to hold their majority in the House as well. And then congressional leaders really kicked into high gear to start to put pen to paper on this. The budget reconciliation process is kind of a unique way to enact legislation in Washington. But ever since like the 80s, it's been a pretty common tool that is used when one party controls the majorities in both chambers of Congress and the White House, but they lack a strong enough majority to override the filibuster, to bypass the filibuster in the Senate, which of course takes 60 votes to accomplish. So that's why they used the budget reconciliation process. Democrats did the same thing with the Inflation Reduction Act when they controlled all three levers of the lawmaking process a couple years ago. So this is a pretty common tool that is used, but it always does mean that a lot of things get put on the table and a lot of things can move. And certainly as it relates to all of agriculture, and more so in my wheelhouse on the livestock side of the equation, we certainly saw a lot of things jam-packed into this bill.
Can I just ask how many pages that bill ended up being when it made it across the finish line?
Yeah, you can ask that. I think when all was said and done, it ended up being around 1,600 pages. Don't quote me on that. Certainly not the biggest bill that I've seen since I've been here, but certainly a lot goes into it. And of course, you have to remember, you know, that there's different versions from the House and the Senate, and then the House has to concur with the Senate. There's a fund provision called the Byrd Rule that factors into how all of this gets enacted into law. And so I've seen about a billion different iterations of legislative text here. So I can't remember what the final count was, but it was hefty. The way that the budget reconciliation process works is that, of course, starts with the budget committee, and they adopt a new budget resolution and then provide instructions to the other authorizing committees in the House and the Senate that says, hey, give us a legislative package that either increases spending or decreases spending based upon the new budget resolution that we have just adopted. And so as a result, every committee does it just a little bit differently, and every committee can report up as many pieces of legislation as they need to in order to achieve that goal with the budget resolution. So it can be pretty hefty.
That's just a lot of pages to comb through. And I know how quickly it came through too, you know, and for that many pages, it made it through the House and the Senate relatively quickly. How do you keep track of what's important for NCBA specifically in 1600 pages of documents? Because you don't have time to read every single page of that.
Well, fortunately, we have a pretty robust team here at the NCBA in the Washington, D.C. office. We've got, I think, 10. We've got 10 registered lobbyists in our office, and everybody works a slightly different portfolio. We've talked before, I cover cattle markets and appropriations. We have lobbyists that cover transportation issues, tax issues, credit issues, international trade, federal lands, Forest Service and BLM grazing, you name it. And so everybody kind of dives into their independent silos and looks at their different sections of the bill, which is very helpful. The other thing too is, you know, I think I mentioned earlier that we've been laying the groundwork for this legislation going back almost 18 months at this point. So we've had a lot of conversations with Republican leadership, not just in the House, in the Senate, in terms of the bodies, the people like Mike Johnson and John Thune. We've also been having these conversations with folks like G.T. Thompson, chair of House Ag, Bruce Westerman, chair of House Natural Resources, making sure that they understand what the priorities are of the cattle industry as they start to piece together these legislative vehicles that will become budget reconciliation. And so that is all how this game works. I think I've said it on the podcast before, but you know, my boss always says we are in the friend-making business. And when you have developed those relationships properly, there's a good back and forth and a good dialogue that happens between the people that are actually putting pen to paper and the people like me who are trying to influence that process through the lobbying efforts that we do here.
Well, that is just entirely antithetical to what we hear in the media, Tanner.
Well, you know, there was a time when a smoke-filled room and a briefcase full of cash may have been involved, but those days are long, long over.
I was even thinking of, you know, this process having even little parts of friendliness to it, but hearing it from someone who is on the ground doing it every day, I'm more inclined to believe you. So,
you know, I've been pretty blunt on this podcast in the past, right? I mean, given that Trump can be loquacious at times, you know, it's hard to sometimes separate through like, all right, is it really a one big beautiful bill? And yes, it has its problems. Certainly when you look at it holistically as an American citizen, there's some things in there that would probably give people some pause. But as an ag lobbyist, particularly a cattle lobbyist, I will tell you that from that lens, it totally lives up to its name. We joke around here, kind of tongue in cheek, that we got 95% of our legislative agenda for 2025 completed in one piece of legislation. It's just jam-packed with a ton of good provisions for agriculture. A lot of that's because we have been working really hard to ensure those provisions stay in there. But we were pretty impressed to see it happen. You know, as is the case with these narrow majorities in both the House and the Senate, it's always a question mark as to what's the Freedom Caucus going to do? What are the moderates going to do? What are the urban representatives going to do compared to the rural ones? You know, do they have a coalition to actually pass this? And what I have learned during his brief tenure is don't ever underestimate Mike Johnson, because every time I think he's incapable of, you know, working any magic to get something over the finish line, he finds some way to pull one more rabbit out of that hat and get it over the finish line. So he did it not just once, but twice. Once to send it to the Senate and another one to concur with the amendments that were made in the Senate. So that was impressive to watch, to say the least, especially since Donald Trump had put forward a very ambitious deadline of July 4th to sign the bill. And by golly, he got it. So
yeah, and that's impressive in itself to have a goal in Congress and actually achieve it too, because there's, like you said, the process is messy. It's 10 different iterations before it ever gets approved. It's impressive. And I think, to give a little kudos, the Republicans made it happen while they had the majority all across the board.
Yeah.
At Peacock Technology, we're transforming dairy farming with robotics and AI.
Our pre-brush and post-spray robots work on rotary milking parlors to ensure consistent udder hygiene, alleviating labor shortages, and maintaining high standards year-round.
Our advanced vision system and online platform integrates data from wearables and body condition scores, giving farmers a complete view of each cow's health and performance. saving time and costs while boosting efficiency and profitability.
Peacock Technology, empowering better decisions for your herd's well-being and productivity. Visit peacocktechnology.com to learn more.
So tell us, Tanner, what are some of those big wins for agriculture in the bill? You sound really, really positive, getting, even if it's tongue-in-cheek, 95% of what your legislative agenda was. That's impressive. So talk to us. What's in there?
Yeah. So the base of the bill that Republicans campaigned on during the 2024 election cycle was tax reform. And more specifically, they wanted to take a lot of the temporary provisions from the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017, which was arguably one of the greatest legislative achievements of the first Donald Trump administration. And they wanted to make several of those provisions permanent. They wanted to go further and make additional cuts to taxes to just make it easier for Americans to keep more money in their pocket. Something I think most of us in agriculture can very much appreciate, considering that there are a lot of challenges there. Chief among our tax priorities at NCBA for as long as I have been here and will continue to be is a full and complete repeal of the death tax. That is by far and away the thing that when we hear from our members and a lot of us in the NCBA that have production ag backgrounds, some of us have firsthand experience with how the death tax can be problematic and trying to transition the farmer ranch to that next generation if there's not the proper estate planning. I know a few of our members who were in the middle of estate planning, but tragically lost a relative before that process was completed. And as we all know, farmers and ranchers, we are land rich and cash poor. And that means that if there comes due a tax bill, you got to liquefy some of those assets. And the biggest asset that is unfortunately the easiest, I guess, to offload is that land. So they've had to sell off chunks of the ranch in order to pay the tax bill. So we've fought for a long time to get rid of the death tax. We were not quite successful in getting that done. There is a lot of angst on not just the Democratic side of the aisle, but also some Republican members look at the death tax, not through the lens of rural America, but I'm sure if you hear Democratic talking points on this issue, a lot of it focuses on the fact that there's this idea that billionaires, the mega rich, the 1%, whatever you want to call them, use the inheritance tax exemptions that would be there in order to basically secure their legacy and their empire. And there's already arguments that they don't pay their fair share of taxes. And so that's why there's usually strong Democratic opposition to a full and complete repeal. What we were able to accomplish, however, was a permanent exemption limit of $15 million for an individual, $30 million for a married couple filing jointly, which is a substantial increase from even the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act exemptions, which were indexed for inflation since 2017. But regardless, that is a huge win. That is permanent. We don't have to worry about that provision expiring in the future. And certainly, depending on where you're at in the country, it doesn't take a whole lot of land to get up to $30 million. But that does provide a little bit more of a cushion. Still very strongly recommend that farmers, ranchers consult with their accountants, their attorneys to make sure that they have a good, robust estate plan in place. But this provision does provide a little bit of flexibility. In addition to that, there were a lot of tax provisions that tools that we use in order to reduce our tax burden that were potentially in jeopardy. Things like the stepped up in basis, which is crucially important in that estate planning process and looking at futuring out what your land transition plans are going to look like. Things like bonus depreciation, things like preservation of 199A, the small business deductions. We were able to preserve a lot of that and even get some modest increases. So on the tax front, we were very glad to see that. On the agriculture side of the equation, a ton of farm bill provisions ended up moving across the finish line in this piece of legislation. Things like the three-legged stool, which in our universe is referring to three very important animal health programs at the Department of Agriculture. And animal health has certainly been on everybody's mind with highly pathogenic avian influenza on the cattle side as well as the poultry side. We've got New World screwworm moving north from Central America. It's now in Mexico. It's now in like Central Mexico and on a northward trajectory, which is frightening. And of course, we're always worried about foot and mouth disease, right? We saw that flag positive in a water buffalo in Germany several months ago. So animal disease preparedness has been our number one priority in the farm bill. And we were able to see that get full funding at the levels that we requested mandatory funding in this One Big Beautiful Bill Act. We also saw some changes to some disaster programs. If you use the livestock indemnity program, for example, for death loss to recoup some of those losses, historically, you were not eligible to receive a 100% indemnity payment if your losses were due to predation from a federally protected species like a gray wolf, depending on what part of the country you're in. That is no longer the case. You now have a 100% indemnity for predation from a federally protected species. And that's just on the livestock side. On the commodity side, there was approximately $66 billion in investments made to Title I programs like ARC, PLC, dairy margin coverage, as well as some investments made back into the crop insurance system that really kind of are designed to bolster the farm safety net. We've talked about reference prices a ton with some of the market conditions, partially just where we're at in commodity marketing cycles, partially because of Donald Trump's use of the tariff to achieve larger trade objectives, and in the short term, the effects that has on ag markets. We've seen some reference price adjustments in previous pieces of legislation, but some of those back-end adjustments to those core Title I programs came through this One Big Beautiful Bill Act. There really wasn't a whole lot from NCBA's perspective that we wanted to see in the bill that wasn't there. In fact, the only thing I can think of is in Chairman Thompson's markup of the Farm Bill from last Congress, there was a provision that dealt with California's disastrous Proposition 12, which I think we've talked on the podcast before. And unfortunately, that was not allowed to stay in the reconciliation package because of what I referenced earlier, which is that bird rule, which doesn't allow certain provisions to go in. And we can dive more into that in just a second. But all that to say, all things considered, we came out very, very strong as agriculture through this One Big Beautiful Bill. Both from a tax perspective and then from general farm policy, that standpoint as well, there's a lot of things to be really excited about in this bill.
That's really good to hear, because I think on social media too, you get the noise from the extremes of both ends and you don't know where everything has landed. And because I'm not as familiar as you are, was like the SNAP cuts and some of the Medicare, Medicaid cuts, was that included in the Big Beautiful Bill, or has that been a separate entity? And does that have an effect on ag in any realm?
It doesn't have a direct effect on what we would call farm policy. But one thing that we have tried to do as agriculture collectively in DC is look at farm policy a little bit more holistically and look at what we would call rural policy, right? Yes, there are some adjustments made to Medicaid, Medicare. There are some adjustments made to SNAP, although they're not significant adjustments. A lot of that is changing, you know, the work requirements and making sure that there's the ability of these states that implement the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program for them to have a cost share component so that the entirety of the burden isn't all on the federal government. Like I said, there's some challenges from that perspective as well. But, you know, when we look specifically through the lens of farm policy, great bill. When we zoom out a little bit and we look at holistic rural community welfare, yeah, there's some challenges there, but they are not insurmountable challenges, at least on the SNAP side. I am not a Medicaid guy by any stretch of the imagination. Those types of programs are very hard. They're like the third rail of politics, Republican, Democrat, it doesn't matter. You don't want to touch those issues. I was with the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee earlier this week, and he reminded me, and I think I've said this before too on the podcast, but you know, when we look at the federal budget, right, only about a third of the federal budget is approved through the congressional appropriations process. So that is literally everything that we work on, from staffing the agencies, implementing programs like the Endangered Species Act, or a lot of farm programming that is not Farm Bill related is through discretionary funding. And the other two thirds of that is mandatory spending. The vast majority of that is entitlements. So think Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, and veterans benefits. Nobody's advocating that we touch veterans benefits. Nobody's really advocating that we touch Social Security, even though there's problems there as well. So oftentimes Medicaid and Medicare are the programs that when you look at entitlement reform, those are the ones that tend to kind of float to the surface as the easiest of the impossible issues to deal with.
Easiest of the impossible. Now there's a phrase I haven't heard before.
Like I said, it is the third rail of politics. Nobody wants to touch entitlement programs.
Yeah, with good reason, for sure.
And what's interesting to me, too, is, I mean, one of Trump's biggest pushes from day one was trying to get the debt under control. And so he started with nitpicking all these government agencies, and now it's coming to very obvious terms that, yeah, Social Security and Medicaid are where true cuts need to be happening. But it's a very emotional topic too, because I think we all know somebody on Medicaid. We all know somebody that's had to go to the food bank at some point in their life. And it's a necessary thing to keep our country fed and have healthy people. And so I don't envy anybody that's having to try to cut some of those programs, because it's highly emotional. And there's story after story about how even through the SNAP program, going and getting a soda one day was something that helped spur somebody's, you know, emotions to get them through the work for the day, you know, and things like that that we don't even think about. So that's a whole nother tangent, but it's definitely a big, big-headed monster for sure.
Yeah, it really is. I think you can say that about, well, any bill, right, that moves through Congress, government, Congress, all of the things, those are big-headed monsters in themselves. But coming back to all the wins that you talked about, Tanner, this, I don't know if I should say unprecedented, that word gets thrown around a lot these days. But that number of wins and those kind of major wins for agriculture are incredibly encouraging, especially on the tax front. You know, talking as someone who has a generational stake in a family business, that can be really top of mind a lot of the time, because if you don't get it right in your family business planning, man, you can take down an entire legacy really, really, really fast. So that's a really, really cool thing to hear. And of course, the farm policy stuff is really encouraging also. And I guess I'm wondering too, you know, your colleagues in other ag organizations, you know, dairymen's, corn growers, soybeans, hogs, you know, your colleagues across those sectors in DC, are they feeling the same way? Is the positivity across the industry?
From my experience, I would say yes. I will say that, you know, I think that of the people that, you know, fared the best in agriculture through the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, cattle producers are probably top of mind. And the main reason I say that is because we don't really have Title I market support systems. We don't participate ARC, PLC, DMC, any of those types of what we would call subsidy programs. And so as a result, you know, when we engage in a traditional farm bill process, we're more so looking at those provisions that are outside of Title I, which is where those types of programs exist. And we look more towards Title 12, which is literally called the miscellaneous title. It's for all of the random stuff. So that's where our animal health priorities come in. That's where things like this Proposition 12 fix come in, processing capacity expansion, those types of projects. And so when we see a lot of those Title 12 type provisions make it over the finish line, that doesn't leave a whole lot left for us to feel like we need to accomplish in a farm bill. We talked about Prop 12 and how that's something that we would like to see done. So I will say that, you know, we kind of viewed this as a big win because we got 99% of our farm bill objectives accomplished in this bill. Not everyone else in agriculture can say that. So while in my experience, there has been a lot of positivity, a lot of excitement about this bill, one thing that we don't do very much of in Washington is resting on our laurels. Soon as we get one legislative package done, we are immediately on to the next. So for us, that's the upcoming appropriations deadline. They have to do something by September 30th in order to keep the government funded. We have a lot of priorities tied up in the appropriations process as well. And we've also been hearing, especially in the last 48 hours, from the agriculture committees in the House and the Senate, that they would like to move the remaining parts of the farm bill before the end of the year, what they're calling a skinny farm bill, which is basically just kind of cleanup from everything that didn't get accomplished in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. So a lot of my agriculture colleagues, particularly those in the row crop, specialty crop side of the universe, are starting to turn their attentions now towards completing their work in the farm bill with the passage of some sort of a legislation to get the rest of those provisions over the finish line.
Going forward, since some of the farm bill was accomplished through the One Big Beautiful Bill, in the next renewal of the farm bill, is it still in the farm bill, or is it like separate, or how does that look going forward on how we're going to maintain these things?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, not to be too flippant about it, but that's been our big question as well, right? I mean, here's the problem. And I think we've also talked about this before, so I hate to sound like a broken record, but I don't think we will ever see a farm bill again that looks like farm bills have looked like in the past. The expiration for all of these programs that got the farm program. So we said the tax stuff was all made permanent, but on the ag side, where we talk about three-legged stool, we talk about crop insurance, mandatory spending on some of that side of the equation. We are, those do expire. Those authorizations run for 5 years. So in theory, what should be happening is if we pass a skinny farm bill later this year, which is a big, big if, but if we pass a skinny farm bill by the end of this year, the expiration for those programs would line up with the expiration of the provisions that made it across the finish line in this reconciliation package, such that when we get to 2030 and we're in what would be considered the 2030 farm bill cycle, the farm bill would be the traditional farm bill. But we have to look at farm bill coalitions now. The reason, and I think everybody knows this, the reason that the food stamp program like SNAP is included in a bill that is traditionally more so geared towards farm policy is because of that crucial farm bill coalition. Because of the 60 vote threshold in the Senate, because of the breakdown of urban and rural representation, you need bipartisanship in order to move a farm bill. And that has been lacking, for lack of a better word, in recent days. And I don't really see an exit ramp for the partisanship that we are experiencing in Washington. 5 years is a long time and a lot can happen in 5 years. But the traditional farm bill coalitions that we would expect to see are shifting. We used to be able to depend on the overwhelming majority, like 95% of Republicans, to be supportive of a farm bill. That's no longer the case. If you look at the makeup of the House Republican delegation, many more of those seats are now from suburban districts as opposed to rural districts. And they have some concerns about the amount of money that we spend on SNAP and some concerns about other ways that we spend on the farm bill. If you look at the Democratic side of the aisle, the same thing can kind of be said there too, that their representation is shifting and it is getting far more urbanized far more quickly. And that means that they are way more interested in the SNAP provisions and virtually could care less about the farm provisions, which isn't always the case. But all that to say, your traditional farm bill coalitions are shifting such that, you know, I'm not going to say we'll never get a farm bill again. I don't think that that's true. But I do think that the days of the farm bill, as we have come to know it over the last several iterations and cycles, I think that will look very, very differently going forward in the future.
I think we've got to wrap our head around that. We're all routine traditionalists too, and we want to expect, you know, those routine things to happen. We want our farm bill. We want our elections every 4 years. We want traditional education, but all that's changing, you know, with technology, with administration, and we've got to be adaptive and fluid with those changes. And I think it's for the better. Like if we can break apart the farm bill and not have to pass one big thing that has a lot of contentious in it, we can get crop insurance, we can get those kinds of things done ahead of time, then we can fight over SNAP, we can fight over those specific things while also protecting what's really important for ag.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I will tell you too, I mean, SNAP often gets portrayed as an urban America program, right? Think inner city, people below the poverty line. The fact of the matter is that SNAP is pretty, there's not a single member of Congress who doesn't have a sizable number of constituents that are SNAP beneficiaries. And that program exists for a reason. It is a good program. You will not hear very many Republicans. There are some, but you will not hear very many Republicans. And I would go so far as to say, you will not hear a single Republican on the ag committees say that we should just abolish SNAP and get rid of it. They see the value in it and they don't want to make cuts to SNAP as a general rule. What they do want to do is make sure that that money is being used wisely and invested properly. And more importantly, they want to reduce fraud in the SNAP program. And they want to make sure that there are some requirements, like you need to be looking for a job. You need to be, you know, if you're an able-bodied person, you need to demonstrate that you're trying to be a productive member of society through either trying to find employment or doing community service or whatever that might look like. It's really unhelpful when we get into the real nitty-gritty of debating a farm bill in the public eye. It's really unhelpful when we start to say things like, and I've heard Democrats say this a lot, and their Republicans are not blameless in this process too, but the number one complaint I hear from Democrats is Republicans are trying to take food out of the mouths of hungry people. That's never been the case. And that is a gross oversimplification of the complexities of this government policy that is designed to do a thing and could be improved upon.
And it's good for ag too, in the fact that we are putting wholesome ag products into hands of people that need it too. And so it benefits agriculture and the production too, because that's, those people aren't eating. We're also not paying farmers either.
Yeah. I mean, it's a hugely cyclical and an important part of how this domestic ag economy works.
Hi, I'm Tom Herron, founder of Ag Professionals. Agriculture is always innovating and evolving, and at Ag Professionals, we provide the expertise to help you stay ahead. From land use planning and environmental compliance, permitting to real estate, civil and environmental engineering, and land surveying, we offer one-stop solutions you need to grow and succeed. We're proud to support the Millennial Ag Podcast because we believe in the future of agriculture. Let's build that future together. Visit our website, agpros.com, to learn how we can help your operation thrive.
Maybe shifting a little bit of gears, one thing that was really hot topic in the big, beautiful bill that got dropped was the public lands situation, specifically for public land users and grazers. And then it blew up to recreationalists all across the country. But can you walk us through the rumors that were flying regarding that? And then what was actual intention and then why it got dropped?
Yeah, so Senator Mike Lee from Utah, who is a pretty conservative Republican, and I will just say from the onset, no friend of NCBA. He is the chairman of the Senate Committee on Energy and Natural Resources, which has the primary jurisdiction over federal lands in the Senate. And of course, you know, federal lands are a hugely passionate topic for people, particularly in the West. Because not only are those lands that, you know, folks that maybe are from back east or the Midwest view as, you know, America's playground, it's a recreational opportunity, which it for sure is. For us in the West, it's way more holistic than that. Yes, it's where we recreate, but it's also where we make our living through mining, oil and gas extraction, grazing. There's all sorts of components that come into that. And the last thing we want to do is sell off wide swaths of public land to private landowners that are going to build fences and keep people out. It's one of the coolest things about America is the ability to go and enjoy these landscapes as the public, which also includes the multiple use theory of utilizing that land for its highest and best use. Anyway, all that to say, Senator Lee, of course, is a firm believer, generally speaking, that the federal government should not own land and that the states are better equipped to administer those landscapes. He's not entirely wrong in thinking that. I think that there's a lot of evidence that suggests that the states are better equipped just from the fact that they are more local to the land. And the more local the knowledge gets, usually the better the outcomes and your ability to achieve objectives are. So part of one of his amendments that he proposed to the reconciliation bill was one which would have authorized a massive sell-off of public lands, which got everybody up in arms. You saw environmental groups, you saw recreation groups, you saw sportsmen's groups get really, really upset about that. And for good reason, because if we are talking about wholesale public lands disposals, that is problematic and is something that NCBA and the Public Lands Council, our sister organization, would not support if it reduced even a single animal unit month for federal grazing. When you start to unpack that provision a little bit and wade your way through all of the media circus that surrounded it, you start to look at a lot of it. The vast majority of what that amendment would have done would have been to authorize a lot of these disposals for county use. So obviously, when we are looking at federal lands and some of these rural counties, think like, let's take a Nevada, because it's an extreme example, right? You have these little bubbles of county land or small towns surrounded by a sea of BLM and Forest Service land. Oftentimes, the lands that are closest to those municipal boundaries or those county boundaries are what we would call marginal use lands. There's not a lot of grazing that goes on there. There's not a lot of oil and gas development. And maybe that county is trying to do an economic revitalization project, right? So sometimes they will do land transfers where they swap out one parcel of land for another. But oftentimes, too, if it makes sense for the economic welfare of that rural community, the federal government will dispose of those lands and transfer it to the management of that more local government. That's what the majority of that provision did. But I will tell you, there's a lot more that goes into it than even I was able to look at because we have a team dedicated to the public land side. But that's the gist of it, right? That's definitely a pretty important part of making sure we have rural vitality in the Western United States as well. I'm not going to say that we're opposed to land disposals and situations like that, but I think the wholesale authorization of it at such a grand scale is, and especially when, to our earlier point, the bill was moving so quickly, that's what got a lot of people up in arms.
And Mike Lee ended up dropping that. Is that correct? So there was no public lands put into the one big, beautiful bill.
He did. He proposed it as an amendment and withdrew that amendment. There was some doubt whether he could have even had the votes to attach that amendment to the bill. But he did, because of the backlash he got, he did withdraw that amendment from the bill, and it was not included in the final passage.
Well, that's good, because it's, like you said, it's probably the disposal and economic benefit. But when it's that fast and furious and it's a lot of public land, it's a small percentage, but it's still a large acreage. It is scary for the public to wrap their heads around that so quickly.
Yeah. And when I worked for the Public Lands Council, right, I mean, it is so, the natural resources policy end of the universe is so immensely partisan. And you have millions, if not billions of dollars of money that is used to influence public policy in this space, both from the sportsman's community, the what I would call land users community between grazers, miners, oil and gas extractors, solar, you name it. And on the other side, you have the environmental groups, some of these more radical, greeny, recreation minded groups, and they've got all this money and they are trying to get what they want and they duke it out in the public. So it's really easy to boil it down to a bumper sticker slogan, right? And think that, oh yeah, keep public lands in public hands. It's not always that simple. When I worked for the Public Lands Council, so much of my time was spent staring at maps of one section of one forest or one section of a BLM grazing allotment in one state or in one county, trying to figure out exactly what the goals and objectives are for that one little area. And we had meeting after meeting after meeting. In Idaho, the Owyhee 68 is a great example. All of those permittees out there trying to achieve land health objectives when we thought we might have a national monument designation. And then there's sage-grouse land use management plans that come into effect there. I mean, that's just one area of the country. And it took up a huge amount of my time. And they're not even done sorting all of that out. So it is immensely complex. And it's never as simple as what you can fit into a 30-second ad buy on Fox News or CNN.
Yeah, no, and it's, I think that's all a policy, and especially when it comes to multiple use and multiple passions involved too, because yeah, there's lots of that. So, well, Tanner, maybe to wrap us up, what's the future look like for NCBA and for, you know, the next steps past the big, beautiful bill? You know, you don't have much breathing room. Once one's done, there's not a lot of celebratory before you're on to making sure something crazy doesn't happen on the next bill that's passing.
Yeah, congressional leadership on the Republican side is looking at a big rescissions package to deal with some of the Democratic spending that was done in the Inflation Reduction Act, among other things, some regulatory rulemaking rescissions as part of that. The next big thing, though, is the fiscal 2026 appropriations process. Like I said, something's got to happen by September 30th to keep the government funded. Otherwise, the government shuts down, which is entirely possible. Donald Trump has proven in the past that he is not afraid of government shutdowns. And then we're, of course, having those initial conversations about a skinny farm bill. Is that possible? Ugh. But what could it look like if it does become possible? Because, again, never underestimate Mike Johnson. On the regulatory front, you know, we're constantly evaluating some of those things. On the deregulation side of the equation, we're trying to look at the BLM's grazing regulations and restore some common sense into that process. Looking at NEPA, ESA, looking at the Packers and Stockyards Division and how they administer policy as it relates to livestock markets, trying to make sure that the EPA gets reined in from some of these court decisions that have resulted in a pretty much full dismantling of the disastrous 2015 Waters of the United States rule. The regulatory agenda continues to grind on, even if the Capitol Hill agenda is a little bit in limbo right now while we try and figure out where they're going to go next. But I will say again, around my office right now, it is all animal health all the time. We talk about screwworm, we talk about high path, we talk about preparedness, we talk about animal disease traceability, because that's where the threat is right now. And that's what we're going to continue to work on to make sure that we maintain the safety and animal welfare of the domestic cattle herd.
I have to say, I really appreciate that because it is frightening. And with the all-time low cattle numbers we have right now, like, we have to keep our cows protected and keep the beef supply chain rocking and rolling to keep people buying our beef. So I appreciate that that was part of the big, beautiful bill and that it's ongoing conversations that are happening, because that's something that Catherine and I have talked a lot about. We haven't talked about screwworm a whole lot, but we have talked about avian influenza and the devastation it could have, and, you know, making sure that that's still on top of mind. So, Tanner, thank you so much for joining us. Where can listeners find more about NCBA and any other plugs you would like to leave listeners with?
Yeah, follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter for the latest out of Washington, D.C. If you're not a member, we would always love to have you join us and be part of that grassroots network that is capable of accomplishing policy victories like this. You can get more information on how to join and how to get involved in the policy process at ncba.org.
Perfect. And we'll link that in our show notes as well. But I appreciate you and all the staff members back there fighting for us, because I don't have the bandwidth to do it. And Tanner, we plug NCBA and you a lot, because that's when things get crazy. I'm like, oh, Tanner's just taking care of it.
Well, there's a good team in on board here. And, you know, we're in constant communication. Holidays, the weekend, something happens. It's just good to see that everybody is keeping an eye out for the industry.
Yeah, most definitely. And thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning into this week's episode of the Millennial Ag Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with your friends and like, subscribe, and review to our podcast. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, or email us at talktous@millennialag.com. Until next week, we are Millennial Ag.